It's 4 in the morning, the end of December. I'm writing you now just to see if you're better. New York is cold, but I like where I'm living. There's music on Clinton Street all through the evening. I hear that you're building your little house deep in the desert. You're living for nothing now. I hope you're keeping some kind of record. Yes, and Jane came by with a lock of your hair. She said that you gave it to her the night that you planned to go clear. Did you ever go clear? The last time we saw you, you looked so much older. Your famous blue raincoat was torn at the shoulder. You've been to the station to meet every train. You came home without Lily Marlene, and you treated my woman to a flake of your life. And when she came back, she was nobody's wife. Well, I see you there with the rose in your teeth. One more thin gypsy thief. When I see Jane's awake, and sends her regards, can I tell you, my brother, my killer? What can I possibly say? I guess that I miss you. I guess I forgive you. I'm glad that you stood in my way. If you ever come by,
the This is Richard Roth with The Passage, a monthly show devoted to the creative life. That was The Handsome Family, a sort of a favorite band of my guest today, an artist, Barbara Friedman, who has a show at the BCB Art, Lower Warren Street, closing on Sunday with a closing reception to which one and all are invited. After the interview, more music by The Handsome Family.
I'm here at BCB Art with the artist Barbara Friedman, who has a show that closes this Sunday. There's going to be a closing party, and we would like to see everyone there. Barbara, welcome. How did you happen to end up showing in Hudson here at BCB Art?
I got an email from Bruce out of the blue a few years ago. He'd seen my paintings online, I guess, and was really pleased to hear from him. We'd gone to RISD together many years ago. We were undergraduates there, but didn't know each other well. Had a few friends in common. And anyway, so he contacted me and said that he liked what I was doing at the time, and did I want to send him some images, and I did, and you know, that led to my first show there.
Were you doing a similar kind of work when you knew each other way back then?
No, I mean, I was a painter, and I was doing, as an undergraduate at RISD, I was doing pretty painterly paintings of swimming pools, actually, that were a little pop-inflected, but, you know, also basic color studies. And Bruce was in printmaking and doing pieces that were kind of wry and a little bit conceptually oriented and if I remember correctly, somewhat text-based. I remember they were also always really funny. I like that. But we didn't know each other well at all.
And so then you went on from RISD to UC Berkeley.
I did. I went to San Francisco, to the Bay Area, pretty much directly from RISD. And I before I went to UC Berkeley, I spent a year painting and teaching full-time. I was teaching in two different, actually, private schools. I taught art and French and continued. And then I did start an MFA program at UC Berkeley, but I continued teaching while I was a student.
And then you came back and started teaching at Pace.
Yes. After I finished grad school, I wasn't sure if I was going to stay in the Bay Area or I was going to move back to New York. When I say back to New York, I had grown up in New York and had left when I was 14 and kind of always vaguely assumed that I would return someday. I just didn't know when. So when I finished Berkeley, I was on the fence about it. But I did go back, and after a few months, I got an adjunct course offered to me at Pace University, and then I took it, and then a few years later, that turned into a tenure-track job, which was great, and let me remain in New York and just paint.
And so you've been there now for 30 years, I think.
I guess I have. I've been there for 30 years, because, yes, exactly.
Wow.
It's kind of daunting, but what can I say?
When did you start doing this particular body of work? The show that's at BCB now is based on copying paintings in museums. And you have, I don't know, close to a dozen paintings here, I guess, plus a number of drawings. When did you start doing this kind of work?
About maybe 2 years ago now. The first time I actually worked on site in a museum was maybe 3 years ago. I applied. I'd always been really curious about those, you know, that sort of strange, I don't know, trope of the copyist and the faithful renderer, or the academic hack, or, you know, they have different guises, but the person who goes to a museum and sets up their easel and faithfully copies a masterwork. And it's such a time-honored tradition, and it's one that I wasn't at all exposed to as a student, because I was an undergraduate in the 70s, and it was, you know, really antithetical to the way I was taught.
At one time, was that the standard practice that you went to the museum and copied?
I think it was, especially in Europe. I mean, and, you know, you still see more copyists, I suppose, at the Louvre than you do at the Met. And, you know, certainly students at the Academy work from plaster casts and the like. And not only was I not educated in that tradition, but it doesn't really go with my personality. I tend to make pretty quick, impulsive pieces. And I'm far too self-indulgent and impatient to really, you know, follow a careful technique, or to consider waiting for laborious glazes to set. And so it's sort of surprising that I'm even interested in the whole idea. But for some reason, I've always been curious about why people would do that and how they came to do that. And I also associated somewhat with ladies or lady copyists, or there's a little bit of a feminist curiosity there too, because it obviously is not a tremendously valued practice, and it has the sting of the copy of it, of the hobbyist to it. And so I think I'm also very interested in what it means to paint from observation, as opposed to, you know, painting from photographs or from your memory, if you paint representationally. And again, you know, working from life, from observation is fine. It's a little old-fashioned and academic. And so I'm always interested when people do it in such a way, you know, that there's something fresh about it. So, for instance, right now there's a fairly young artist named Josephine Halverson who is, you know, painting from observation. I mean, she tends to travel to make her paintings, and she'll focus on maybe a piece of wall that tends to go ignored. And she does, I think, all of her paintings, she does all of her paintings in one setting. I mean, in one sitting. I think that's part of her practice, emphatically. And then, you know, somebody like Rackstraw Downs does the same thing, though, of course, he does much more labor-intensive, lengthy paintings, though they both seem to far prefer depicting a place that wouldn't be considered particularly picturesque. And so I don't know, the people who do that and insist on their presence, and who feel that there's something experiential in being there and looking, I'm sort of curious. I wonder if you really feel it in the painting. I'm not sure you do, but Catherine Murphy does that too. You know, I'm sort of fascinated by the fact that she has this painting of her husband, of his head, and he's lying on, a garage floor, and she made him get back in that uncomfortable pose over and over and over again instead of using a photograph. And, you know, does one feel that in the painting, that craziness? And I'm not necessarily, I mean, I certainly have sometimes paint from photographs out of my head. I manipulate images. I've always been a studio artist, though occasionally I make work from observation. And in this case, I really wanted to set up strict guidelines and adhere to them and see what happened. And it ended up involving my painting in museums.
So now, if you're standing in front of a Goya or a Rembrandt, yeah, or whatever, and you're copying it, the finished product is, of course, not a line for line copy. Do you, at some stage in the painting, is it pretty much a representation of exactly what the painting looks like?
Well, yeah. I mean, usually they end up looking, I mean, some of them are barely recognizable. And the original source pretty much disappears, though not entirely, but mostly. Generally, at the beginning, they do look, I wouldn't say, they don't, certainly don't look exactly like the painting that I'm looking at. You know, I see these paintings as portraits of the sitters in many ways, as much as they are about the artists that painted them. And you know, they're pretty much all of people. There's one painting that I have three paintings that are from that painting. One of them is much closer to the painting than the others. It's a portrait of a Dutchman. I'm trying to, I think it's Van Ostend. It's just called, let's see. It's Jacob Bakker. It's a minor Dutch master. This was in the Brooklyn, that's in the Brooklyn Museum. I don't think it's in the Brooklyn Museum anymore, but it was when I painted it. There's one that's much more faithful to what it actually looks like. And then the one with the scratched out orange face is the same painting. And that one with the collar, I ended up being really interested in the figure ground flipping that occurs. Again, I didn't think that would be the point of the painting, but it ended up being. It ended up being what I was interested in.
Now, at some point, was there a lot more paint on the surface?
Yes, there always is at some point a lot more paint on the surface.
And how much time do you spend on one?
That's a good question. They've tended to happen faster and faster, which is a little unsettling, and I don't want to necessarily be the case. Usually it's anywhere from 1 to 3 sessions. And the sessions are pretty restricted because I can only be there when the museum lets me be there, and I'll get a permit, and the permit is maybe for a month, 2 or 3 days a week,
and a limited
3
number.
Hours a day or something like
that.
Yeah, and I'm not necessarily there all 3 hours.
And when you're painting, do people come and look over your shoulder and comment and so
Absolutely.
On?
Absolutely. And that's also where the performance anxiety comes in, because I'm not interested in being the snobbish painter that, you know, is doing something that nobody appreciates, you know, that the general museum going populace, you know, doesn't get. But I'm also not interested in just doing a copy, because I'm really not a copyist. I mean, that's really not my project. However, I don't want to be mocking that tradition particularly either. I'm just sort of I'm riffing on it without, but not in a scathing way. So since I start out by doing by painting the painting somewhat, you know, people might be impressed and say, "Wow, that's cool guy," and they seem to like the fact that I have done it quickly, and that's just the way I paint. So like maybe they'll see me setting up, and then a half an hour later, there'll be something that superficially looks like the painting, and they like that. And then 5 minutes after that, I'll eradicate it completely, and I'll hear gasps, and then you know, and that feels weird, and I'm not doing it for you know, and then after that, God knows where the painting goes, and you know, any audience there is probably, you know, not interested in the painting. You know, once I start getting interested, but also anxious because I have no idea where the painting is going either, I really lose my audience. And I'm also conscious of the fact that now everybody around me thinks that I can't paint, which, you know, feels kind of weird. But, you know, what can I say? So that's the trajectory.
So the painting is actually finished on site.
Yes, I have these rules that it's got to be finished on site. It doesn't have to be finished in a single sitting. I can let it dry, you know, take it home. You know, some museums will let me leave it there. The Met, if you know, the Met is incredibly strict, but they will let you leave the painting there. And then return to it, you know, bring it back on site, but I never touch them when they're not on site. I mean, I won't work on it in my studio later. I mean, I have to work on it in front of the painting.
How many paintings in this series have you done, do you suppose?
I'm not sure. Let's see. How many paintings are here? There are about 15 here or something.
Something
like that. So maybe I've done like 40 or so.
Oh.
I'm not, you know, I've also done tons of other head paintings, some of which are art historically informed, but I didn't do them in museums, so I don't count them. Uh-huh. I do see this divide between work that I really did on site and other sort of portraits that, so to speak, that were not done on site. I also do drawings on site.
Yes, talk about the drawings a little bit, too.
Well, you know, on days that I didn't have a permit, and it is hard to get permits, I drew in museums. This is like, again, this was only the last year or so. And I found, I tried different mediums. I use pencil or watercolor. You're not really allowed to use watercolor at the Met. But and I also use charcoal. And I found that my drawings were really kind of pedestrian and boring and just these straightforward drawings based on whatever I was looking at. They didn't really interest me. But I did persist in doing them, hoping that maybe I could paint from them because I figured I would let myself paint from drawings that I did on site. One day, I was using a sketch pad that a friend had given me, and it was a pastel sketch pad that had glassine inserts in between the pages. And it was completely coincidental that I used that sketch pad, just happened to grab it when I left. You know, I did whatever drawing I was doing, closed it, threw it in my backpack, and came home. And when I opened it, I realized that the imprint of the charcoal drawing, I'd been using vine charcoal that day, but the imprint that had transferred to the glassine, you know, essentially it was a monoprint, was actually really interesting and infinitely more interesting than the original drawing. So after that, I would do, you know, deliberately do drawings in this sketchbook, and then I ordered another sketchbook like it, and I would just do a drawing, try not to think about the fact that, you know, that I would want to see what it looked like on the glassine. I would just do a drawing, as I had done before, close the sketchbook, put it in my backpack, and then open it when I came home. Again, I would try to keep these rules. And then whatever had transferred would be the drawing. And, you know, sometimes it, you know, much more transferred than other times. Sometimes it was full of, you know, finger marks or, you know, various disturbances, which could or could not be interesting. But whatever it was, it was. And I did really like that mediation. So those are the drawings.
And can you go and draw at the museum without a permit?
Oh, absolutely. Anybody can draw at the museum. Uh-huh. It's a question of wet or dry media, really. People are really worried that, understandably, that work can get ruined. And I was surprised because somebody posted a photograph that had been taken of me painting at the Brooklyn Museum. They posted it on Facebook, and I didn't realize the photograph was taken. Originally, and then I knew that somebody had taken it, but I didn't know it was going to be posted on Facebook, and it elicited a lot of comments because I was holding a really big brush, like a really big brush, and I was painting from a Rembrandt, and it looked like I was actually a lot closer than I was. Somehow the photograph really collapsed, flattened the space, and it was interesting how many people on Facebook that didn't know me, you know, remarked, you know, on that proximity and how terrifying it was and what could happen. And you know, even though the painting was, in fact, covered by glass. But still, it was interesting. And it made me think about, I guess, my relationship to, I don't know, vandalism or, you know, the subversive aspects. And I was, at the time, there was this thing going on where there was that art heist by some Romanians, and this this guy, I don't know, what was it? The thought was that he'd given it to his mother, who'd hidden the paintings in the village, in their village, and I don't know, I was intrigued by that. And then there was also something about this woman who was painting green stripes on different paintings, on different masters. I don't know, somehow I haven't really resolved, or I haven't really located myself within this framework, but there was something that I was just interested in, like, I don't know, what is my relationship to being so close to these pieces?
When you're teaching, do you have a particular, are you teaching a technique, or what do you teach?
Oh, when I paint?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm a pretty, I guess I'm a pretty open-minded teacher. I mean, yeah, I teach, I don't know how technique-based my class is. It's, I do teach, you know, painting 1 and 2. And I've taught painting for years. But I think I encourage even beginning painters to find their own voice. And I try to give them the vocabulary for that. I mean, you know, we start with a pretty basic vocabulary, but I do let them extend themselves fairly rapidly.
How many students do you have in a class?
Well, Pace theoretically sets the cap at 17, but you tend to allow more people to add. So it could be up to 20.
And do you sometimes follow students through more than 1 year in
Oh, absolutely. Yes, it's always really gratifying to have returning students, and to, I mean, that's I guess part of the joy of teaching, to see them evolve.
And that's something you do enjoy teaching.
Oh, I do. I mean, I love being in the studio, though right now I'm using the museum as my studio.
Now, what about your earlier paintings, like school buses and hammocks and things like that? Those are also painted from life?
No. Those were a mixture. They were painted, you know, I did do some sketches on the spot, but I also took a lot of photographs. And the way in which I paint makes the image, you know, disappear and reappear and morph and mutate. So at a certain point, I'm just responding to the painting. Though, you know, so often I'll start with an image and it disappears, and then it eventually reappears, usually in a different form. But and that's true for these paintings too. I don't think the process is very different here. It's just the imagery is different. The source material. One thing that I just touched on earlier was this idea of the fact that these were really portraits of these long deceased models, or these. So there is something really compelling for me about painting these subjects who are no longer alive but feel very alive. And not only am I identifying with the artist in question who painted them, but, you know, I feel like I'm in the presence of their subjects. And so that's, there's something I find very compelling about that, and that hopefully might be communicated in the works.
Are there painters whose subjects you find an easier connection with?
That's a good question. Oh, I guess another way of putting that would be, how do I choose which paintings I make a painting of? And I leave that completely open. I have tended to work with a sort of Western canon mostly, though that could shift. But I think I just wander through certain rooms at the Met or the Brooklyn Museum, or I actually loved working in the Hispanic Society as well, and let whatever speaks to me. And
when you go to paint, though, have you already chosen where you're going to paint, or what painter you're going to work from?
That's a good question, because at the Met and the Brooklyn Museum, you need to identify the painting beforehand that you're going to work from. So I do choose it before.
You sort of location scout or something?
I totally location scout. And then, you know, and then you have to apply to paint that painting, and they have to make sure that the room the painting's in is not too crowded, and you won't be obstructing too many visitors' viewpoint. Which brings to mind something else that's interesting. At the Met, for instance, the painting that you make gets stamped with a stamp that says, "This is a copy." So I find that amusing.
Where do they put the stamp?
On the back of the painting. So that in and of itself could make an interesting piece. In every museum, you have to be you're not allowed to make a painting from a painting that's the same size as the original, which also ensures that it couldn't be mistook for the original.
I've seen in European museums, I think, people will make the painting smaller than the canvas. I mean, there's sort of a blank frame around the actual
Oh, that's
image.
Interesting. So, I mean, I guess any marker, any signifier that, you know, alerts the audience that this isn't the original. You know, similar to Magritte's painting, Ceci n'est pas une pipe, you know, it's just... So that's an issue. Of course, I've been allowed... I'm only really supposed to paint the one painting, but since I paint quickly, what I did at the Met, the last time I was at the Met, I was only allowed to paint this one Goya, this redheaded Goya here. But I did many paintings of her. None of them, you know, look anything like each other, but that was my way around only being allowed to paint from that one painting.
And you take more than one canvas at a time?
What I did was they let me, I don't think most people do this, but they did let me store a few small panels in their storage room. So I had a few ongoing.
Now, you knew pretty early on you were going to be an artist, right?
No, I think I always loved drawing and painting, and I came to it pretty naturally. I think I was really scared to say I'm going to be an artist. It seemed like such a, it seemed so full of hubris and so loaded with such big expectations. So I didn't really dare to say that until I was, I guess, around 20. But I always, as a kid, I kind of acted the part of the class artist. Meaning that I was the one who drew, and I was the one who other kids would ask to draw something. But I think that I thought I would be a writer because I read a lot, and I was more identified in a way with just reading constantly. And I made the mistaken assumption that if you read constantly, you would write. But I realized later, really, I like to read more than I like to write. But I did, in fact, really like to draw and paint.
And then you decided by the time you were a teenager to go to art school anyway?
Well, I didn't start out going to art school. I went to a small liberal arts college in Wisconsin first and thought I might major in English. And then, in fact, ended up graduating early and majoring in art because I had enough electives to do so. But I didn't feel in any way ready to consider graduate school. I felt like I was just beginning. So I decided to transfer as an undergraduate to RISD. So I was 2 years older than the rest of my classmates when I did that because I already had a BA. And after I got to RISD, I guess I started following a kind of conventional path towards being an artist and started to self-identify as an artist. But even then, it seemed so presumptuous. I mean, such a presumptuous thing to assume. I guess at a certain point when I was living in San Francisco, I realized, yeah, this is what I do. You know, there was a certain, it felt sort of inevitable. I think when I started painting, just sort of painting, I did fall in love with paint itself, and so I started to look at a lot of artists from whatever period who also, you know, really used paint with hunger and excitement. And so whether it was, you know, Gustin or Goya or Kooning or, I don't know, Alice Neal, I didn't, you know, I looked at them all.
Do you paint a lot? I mean, do you paint every day?
You know, I try to. And my youngest daughter just left for college, and so I'm going to try to be even more disciplined about really getting into the studio or into the museum or every day. But I do teach full time, so it is a juggling act, and summers are particularly sacred. But yeah, it's definitely ongoing for me.
You work in the city all the time, or do you have some country place somewhere?
I don't. I mean, I work in the city. The city is my only real studio. And I live in the same place as I have a studio. Though my husband is Greek-American, and his father's from this tiny village off the coast of Turkey. And he inherited a little house in that village. And we do try to go there in the summer, if possible, for a few weeks. And so that's another place that I paint.
You do a different type of work there?
Well, at one point, it really informed, you know, directly informed my work. I tend to work in series, and narratively, my work often tends to be dramas of displacement. And it was very conscious that pretty much everybody in that little Greek village, or a huge percentage of them, had moved to Cleveland, Ohio, like my husband's family had. And so for a while there, I was making works that involved, you know, the idea of everybody from a certain place, in this case, that particular village, moving somewhere else. And when they were in the village, or when they were in Ohio, seeing the village, you know, never really always inhabiting both places at the same time. So I would conflate elements of both in one piece. And when I was in Lekka, the village, I would paint over Cleveland maps. That's a time when I actually did work from observation. I would just paint straightforward views of the village from observation over maps of Cleveland or over a Cleveland guidebook, thus, you know, containing both places on one page, so to speak.
You have any particular plans for are you continuing this work for now? Or you?
Yeah, I feel very involved in this work. I'm not sure, you know, what it will become. But for the moment, I want to keep haunting these museums. And, you know, I can imagine making paintings in front of paintings that look absolutely nothing like the paintings I'm working from. I could imagine, you know, looking at a portrait and having the painting I make become a landscape. I mean, many of them already become total abstractions, or practically total abstractions. But again, they have to surprise me. And I don't like working from too much of a preconceived plan. But yeah, I feel like I've only scratched the surface, though, here.
Have you shown this work in places other than BCB?
Yes. I mean, I was in a show in Bushwick at Studio 10. That was a 4 or 5 person show of artists that referenced art history in various ways, including a video artist who had a video portrait of de Kooning. And I also showed some of them at Valentine Gallery in Ridgewood, Brooklyn. And I'm going to have some work at Storefront, a gallery in Bushwick, also run by Debbie Brown, that opens in December. So that's basically where, you know, the different venues that I've shown this work in. But it's, like I said, I've only been doing them about 2 years.
Do you have any particular feeling toward Hudson River School painters?
Yes, actually. The series I did before this one that I showed at Bruce's, actually, I guess about 4 years ago, was pretty overtly influenced by the Hudson River painters. Maybe that's one of the reasons I so love the train ride from New York to Hudson. But and I call that series Overlook Paintings, and that's because the word I like the word overlook because it's an auto antonym, and an auto antonym is a word that means the opposite of itself, and overlook suggests a negligent way of seeing, to overlook something, and of course it also means an all-inclusive look where you see everything. And since all my work is really about trying to figure out where I am and to renegotiate my bearings, because I always feel like I'm not really seeing whatever it is I'm seeing. It's all very Proustian in a way. Those overlook paintings were really about seeing and not seeing. And they all tended to be landscapes, and often landscapes that felt like they were a bit of a takeoff on the Hudson River School, because there would be these suggestions of majestic places, projectiles, overlooks with tiny figures, looking over some vast terrain. I mean, it was all very, very greatly abstracted. Sort of Hudson River School meets color field painting. And I actually did one painting based on a Hudson River painting. It was Kindred Spirits. So yes, so the landscape and the river and the moves me pretty deeply.
You grew up as a city girl?
I did grow up as a city girl. I grew up in New York City, but I left at 14. My parents were a lot older, and my father retired when I was 14, and my mother was Swiss and wanted to return to Europe. Felt that if she didn't live in New York City, she didn't want to be in the United States. So we moved to France when I was 14. And I didn't come back to the States until college, I mean, at all. And I had this fantasy about returning to the States, because also it was during the height of sort of hippiness and, all of that. And I felt like I was really missing out.
And meanwhile, you were speaking French as your daily language, I guess.
I was, yes, yes. Though I didn't, I went to American schools. I didn't go to French schools, but I did speak French, and I spoke French as a kid. Actually, after 9/11, my work started emptying out. It had gotten increasingly narrative, and then got more and more pared down. It's interesting because in 1915, Paul Klee said that as people or as artists get scared, their work gets more abstract. And I certainly found this to be true for myself. And that was the time when I would do these pared down landscapey pieces of, that might contain a hammock or an abandoned chair or a school bus. And the narratives were implied, but, merely suggested, certainly not really articulated. The first time that really happened was I was doing a painting of a girl in a bikini lying in the snow under a hammock. And I was thinking of this movie by Agnès Varda named Vagabond, in which a homeless girl is found buried in the snow. And this was my version. But I ended up really disliking the figure because it seemed really literal, and I painted her out. And I put a pink underpainting down on the before I started the painting, and the pink came through and made the snow rosy. And there were shards of pink that kind of formed the hammock. And that was the first time that I really left the underpainting, or left little pieces of the underpainting, and allowed them to determine the figure. And I started doing that regularly after that. And I would just take more and more out. And that was, that became my process in a way. I mean, you know, my process in all of the work is the same, pretty much, where I put down a hot color, and, you know, sometimes parts of it become the positive space, you know, the underpainting, or I scratch into it, or I let parts of it show through, and, you know,
Well, so, for example, this painting where there's this hot pink, that's actually...
That's underpainting.
That's underpainting, I see.
Yeah, and the green is underpainting next
I
to
see,
it.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Because one would get the impression that it was put on afterwards.
Oh, not at all, yeah. And that's so like, you know, I'm constantly like, no, that painting looked not, you know, when I sort of painted that Rembrandt with the green, for instance, that, you know, that looked very different. Then I took it all out and then I scraped into it and pieces came up, you know, all of that. But I never really know what, and then some of them have very little underpainting that shows through, like that one. I mean, they're just little bits, but you
and
know,
how are you removing the painting? You're scraping it off. You're
I'm
wiping
doing different,
it off.
Almost always scraping, but I have different tools. You know, I have one tool. It's this. It's like this, just a scraper, and then you know. But then I also have like tools with a rubber point.
When you do that, scratching out, you're consciously drawing, really, right?
Yes, and some of them are much more about drawing than others. I mean, in terms of the pink dress, I mean, you can see I changed tools for the arms there. That's just a line drawing with, you know, that's scratched into it. Doing the Rembrandts, those two are, you know, that yellow underpainting thing there, and then the other, the greener, they're both Rembrandts. So it's sort of interesting because they're so un-Rembrandt-like in terms of attitude. But when he has these, like, really bright highlights, you know, these strong lights, it's kind of interesting. And that's a Goya, you can sort of tell. And the orange is an underpainting there. But I don't, you know, again, I try to do different, I try not to do the same kind of thing each time, because that's, you know, and I never, I don't know. But what I like about that yellow one that you brought up, I mean, it's not, it's just that it's not typical in that it's not scratched into it. What happened was I really didn't like the painting, and I normally don't have terp with me, so I can't, but I had a little terp with me, and so I really wiped the entire painting away, not because I wanted to see what would happen, but because I just wanted to get rid of it. Uh-huh. And so it's a weird surface because everything's been wiped down. And so the yellow is just where the paint didn't stick. So it kind of came up unexpectedly. I didn't make any decisions about where it would come up. I find that more interesting. So for me. But that doesn't always happen. I mean, you know, that's the sort of... So process is really important.
Is there anything else you'd like to, for the public to know?
God. No, I can't think of anything else. I've enjoyed talking to you, though.
I'll say thank you very much for joining me today, Barbara.
Thank you, Richard. It's been really pleasant.
Butterfly. as meteors die and shot across the sky. I thought about your sad, shining eyes. I came back for my clothes when the sun finally rose, but you were still passed out on the floor. Listen.
A billion birds can do.
Passenger Pigeons by the Handsome Family, alternative country band. Before that, So Much Wine, and before that, an interview with Barbara Friedman, the artist. This is Richard Roth, and this has been The Passage. Thank you.